Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And desperate acts from desperate people, says President Obama.
ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. They may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior. And people like this ultimately fail.
We will assess how ISIS, or ISIL, as President Obama calls it, is doing, delivering its message, getting the attention of the White House, and making gains on the ground in Iraq in just a moment. Also this hour, we revisit the radically different points of view in incidents like the Michael Brown shooting with award-winning actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith. Also, award-winning documentary filmmaker R.J. Cutler tries out his directorial skills on a romantic feature, If I Stay, we'll talk to him. And the man who brought yoga to the West, a celebration of the life of B.K.S. Iyengar. But let's look closely at ISIS, or ISIL, that got the attention of the world with the video showing the horrible beheading of American journalist James Foley, someone they had been holding on to since 2012 and demanding ransom for until he became the gruesome star of an ISIS propaganda film. Officials at the White House said a special ops team had tried to rescue Mr. Foley and other hostages during a secret mission this summer, but failed. We turn now to terrorism expert Rita Katz, founder of the Washington, D.C.-based Site Intelligence Group. ISIS, she says, is a complete package. Ideology, army, media strategy, and business model rolled into a single, terrifying global entity.
The bottom line is that we are dealing currently with probably the most dangerous group that exists within the jihadi world, or maybe in general. The brutality of the group, as was discussed yesterday by President Obama in his press conference, is something that cannot be tolerated. But what really struck me the most while I was watching the video 2 days ago was the fact that we have been exposed to these images before. This resembles very much the previous beheadings, the old beheadings that we saw by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the founding father of ISIS, when he beheaded Nicholas Berg back in 2004. And it's just amazing that 11 years later, we are all still exposed to the same images. After all the war on terror that we have been all involved in, we are still exposed to a terrorist organization that the brutality is something we cannot really tolerate or accept. At the same time, the video execution of James Foley really bears a very important element, not only of intimidation, but had also another level, a very important level, and maybe as equal as to the intimidation, and that is of the recruitment for jihad, recruitment of prospective jihadists.
Well, I mean, the original Al-Qaeda was kind of a franchise operation where Osama bin Laden, had this ideology and people were inclined to join, and only very specialized individuals like Mohammed Atta were actually capable of carrying out tactics like 9/11. This seems to have evolved into something almost like a corporation where you've got a business model and the taking of hostages and getting of ransoms. You've got a media outlet in the sense that these are high quality, multi-camera, fully edited videos. And then you've got an organized, army on the ground with modern weaponry and streams of revenue to acquire more weapons. I mean, watching that video yesterday, it occurred to me, next stop, suicide bombings in Mall of America.
Well, that's a threat that I think every person involved in counterterrorism is extremely worried about. The organization that released the video, the media organization of ISIS, is one that is called the Hayat Center, the Life. And it's very important to understand that this is the organization that had one purpose only, and that is the recruitment of Western only. And since it existed, I would say that ISIS, more than any other jihadi group that I can recall has been investing in Western media outlets, English-speaking magazines, videos featuring suicide bombers from the West, including Canada, Germany, and others. The threat of homegrown that will move and be part of ISIS operation is extremely, extremely alarming. And this is a war that is being fought, John. It's very important to remember, very much online, very much on our social media also, because, you know, with jihadi groups, you can, of course, execute attacks, but without media, without propaganda, without recruitment, jihadi group will not exist. It needs the support, the grassroots support. It needs the recruitment. And currently, social media is the platform that ISIS is using very aggressively for recruitment.
It occurs to me that we haven't learned any lessons in the war on terror. I mean, going back to Osama bin Laden, he tried to get the U.S.'s attention and conducted various terrorist attacks, and eventually with 9/11 got U.S. attention. It seems that ISIS is doing the same thing, ratcheting it up, trying to get full U.S. attention, and is going to escalate this to the point where the U.S. is fully involved, as we were in the Iraq and Afghanistan invasions. And the only way to do that is to have people with U.S. passports and Western passports who can land at JFK Airport and infiltrate the United States. What are we doing to stop that?
Well, that's a great question. I think that at the moment, one of the things that must be realized by Washington and other countries is that drone attacks are not enough. You are fighting here an ideology. You're fighting here an idea. You're fighting here social media campaigns that is being very successful in recruiting all the foreigners. The bottom line is that every country today in the West is asking and wondering, how come that we have so many of our people fighting in Iraq or in Syria? You saw the video. The executor himself has a British accent, and as of now, most likely is from London. That's the latest we hear. This wasn't for no reason that they placed an individual from the West to execute the beheading. For ISIS, it creates a huge media impact. And John, 3 hours after the beheading, Twitter was full with new hashtags, with tweets celebrating this video, celebrating the beheading. The problem is, we are fighting Al-Qaeda and the jihadism for 14 years, at least since 9/11, very aggressively on ground. And that's the funny thing, is that Al-Qaeda is not the most dangerous organization anymore. You're dealing with even more dangerous after Al-Qaeda. This is something that the West must really consider very strongly, because the Al-Qaeda rhetoric, ISIS rhetoric, ISIS propaganda is in the house of many people in the West.
All right, Rita, let me before we go, one more thought on the recruiting. It seems to me that years ago, going back to 9/11, as you've just referred, that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was very effective in recruiting disaffected, wealthy, educated Saudi men with no real opportunity in their life, with no real future. They didn't have a place in that society. And boom, they're in Al-Qaeda, and they become the foot soldiers for 9/11. What you're suggesting here is that ISIS is doing the exact same thing, targeting disaffected men in the West, in Europe, who don't have a place in the economy, who don't have a future. And you say that message is going to find fertile ground.
Well, regarding the recruitment, even with Al-Qaeda, it's not only individuals that didn't have their place in the society. The problem is that the power, the media outlets are extremely powerful, and they have various lessons or various messages to their followers. You can find individuals that had very good location in their society. They were part of the community, yet they found themselves going and executing suicide attacks with Al-Qaeda from the West. And so the question is beyond that. The question is, what is so appealing, there are several things that we must consider, is that one is what is so appealing when these propaganda, and how can we allow this propaganda? How are we going to stop this propaganda from coming into our houses? If you look at our reports, we just recently published a large report, a study, a comprehensive study about even the recruitment of women to Syria and Iraq, part of ISIS operation. Due to the fact that a lot of men are joining their lines, they needed also women. And you'll find a lot of women from the West that are willing to leave everything behind, their family and everything, to move to Syria and work there as a housekeeper just to marry a jihadist and serve him with anything that he needs. The point here is that there is much more to be done. We have not done enough on the online war to stop this. I mean, if this problem will not be dealt on multiple levels, from the recruitment, radicalization, and at the same time in a military operation, the problem might just be something that every country might experience it even worse.
Rita Katz is a terrorism analyst and founder of Site Intelligence Group, which monitors extremist activity online. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
It was an old-fashioned impulse of public service journalism for the old-fashioned Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. After looking at some alarming statistics about women murder victims in the state, the editors decided to investigate why South Carolina ranks so high in incidents of domestic violence. Their 8-month investigation put faces and voices behind the statistics.
There were nightly fights, physical, emotional abuse was always in the house. He would grab her arms really, really tight to the point that there would be bruising left. He would slap her. He would hit her. Very, very violent, very, very loud, very, very physical.
That is Tina Abbasi speaking about her abused mother who was eventually killed, strangled in 2008 by her husband. He served 2 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter. The Post and Courier found case after case where women whose abusers were well known, where victims' fear of harm was clearly understood by neighbors and even the authorities, but still the abuse ended in death. In South Carolina, the murder rate for women in the state is twice the national murder rate for women. Glenn Smith is the project's editor at the Post and Courier, who helped to take on this extensive, groundbreaking project, which he hopes will encourage real reform.
Last year, the Violence Policy Center in Washington, D.C. ranked South Carolina number one in the nation in the rate of men killing women. We had been in the top 10 for the past 15 years and had been number one 3 times. My colleagues and I started talking about it and said we really need to get at why this is happening. What are the factors that are driving this violence here that are pushing us at the top of the list, a small state leading the nation in violence against women?
Is there some culture of tolerance for domestic violence that you discovered in South Carolina?
I think there is, to some degree. It's a very patriarchal society here, has been since its inception, very male-dominated power structure in government and business and other walks of life. I think there is a long-standing traditional belief, religious-based to some degree, that a man's home is his castle. What goes on there is his own business, and people, to some degree, again, turn a blind eye to this violence. It's not something that's often discussed outside the home.
What surprised you? What cases did you look at, and what particular stories stood out?
Well, we looked at over 300 cases that occurred since 2005. A number of them were just horrifying. One that really comes to mind is a 2012 case out of Richland County near the state capital of Columbia. A woman named Takora Thomas, she was 27 years old, had been trying to leave her husband, who did not want to give up on the relationship. She did everything she could possibly think of to protect herself, restraining orders, bought herself a taser, changed the locks on the house, notified people, called the police, and nothing saved her. She was essentially left to her own devices in the end. Her husband, when she came home to clear out her belongings to leave, he was hiding in the closet, jumped out, killed her, tried to kill her mom. He's now serving a 45-year prison sentence.
What does law enforcement do in these cases? Do they think there's a problem? Is there any preventive measure that you discovered in the state of South Carolina?
There's no coordinated effort. I think that's part of the problem. In some places like Massachusetts and Maryland, it's a much more coordinated effort where police, prosecutors, probation officers, victim advocates, they work together to try to determine the cases that are most at risk, high-risk cases, and come up with a plan to protect those victims. Here, it's very hit or miss. Some departments do a decent job. Others are very undertrained, not sure what they're doing. I don't think it's ambivalence at all on the police part. I think it's a lot of cases they don't know what to do to protect these people, or they're not aware of the danger they're in.
You know, one of the things that's not hit or miss as a result of your investigation is the idea that this notion of violence and tolerance of violence is inherited, passed from generation to generation.
Yeah, I heard that over and over again in talking to victims and talking to counselors and police. They might go to a home after a domestic violence incident and they see the son punching the mom or punching his little sister. Guys grow up to believe that this is how you treat women. Women grow up to believe that this is how you're supposed to be treated by your man. So it really is, I think, passed on from generation to generation.
What is the impact on young people in some of the families that you looked at? Do you have a story or an incident which really underscores that part of the problem?
Yeah, there was a fellow we spoke to, Christian Rainey, from the city of North Charleston. He was away at college in Louisiana a few years ago when he got a call from home telling him to come home right away, and they wouldn't say why. He came home and found that his stepfather had been charged with killing his mom and his four siblings. And he has spent the past few years trying to come to terms with that. And he's now a firefighter in North Charleston, but it's still something he struggles with mightily.
If you are a woman who feels that you're at risk, what are the steps that you can take? I mean, what infrastructure exists in the way of shelters or any kind of sanctuary?
Well, we have 18 domestic violence shelters in this state, and that compares to 46 animal shelters, one for each county. So some counties are better off than others. The urban areas, I think, have better resources. A few rural areas have answered the call, but there's still a lot of gaps in the safety net.
What do you think could be done at the state level to correct this? Is it a matter of legislation or more awareness?
I think it's a combination of both. I think some of our laws are fairly lenient when it comes to punishment. On a first offense, criminal domestic violence charge, it's a maximum of 30 days in jail. And 10 years passes, that wipes off your record. 5 years passes, you can petition to have it expunged from your record, even if you've been convicted. That compares to if you abuse your dog, that's a 5-year felony.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, we thought so.
Is there a quote from an individual, say, an actual perpetrator or a woman victim in one of these cases that stands out in your mind?
One quote that comes to mind is came from a woman named Alicia Alvarez, who had struggled with abuse and trying to leave a really damaging relationship. And she was trying to explain to us why it's so hard for women in these positions to leave. And she said, it begins with these little criticisms, the second guessing of everything you do. And these abusers, she said, they get in your brain so that when they tell you you are worthless, you truly believe it. And, I mean, that's a very stark reality for somebody to be living in.
Absolutely. Glenn Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Glenn Smith is a projects editor for The Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. Yesterday, we explored the very different points of view regarding the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
When looking at protesters in Missouri, it seems like the community is divided amongst people that want peace and others that resort to violence, like looting. How is this community going to come together?
That's Jake from California, and he was answered here by Kelly from St. Louis.
I think one of the biggest takeaways from Ferguson and what I hear people responding to on your show is that they teach their children to be colorblind. When you do that, it's actually a form of racism because there is discrimination in this country, and we are a racist country. So when you teach your children not to see race, you're denying the opportunity to teach them about oppression and how white people are privileged at the expense of racial minority groups.
And Alejandro takes Kelly's thought even farther here.
As a Hispanic just living, you know, in this, it's really become a black and white issue when in reality the nation is not black and white. Where is this place for Hispanics? Where's the place for any Asian background? Where's the place for anyone else who isn't black and white? We are getting marginalized much more in this debate, and everyone else gets left behind.
Thanks for joining the conversation. Playwright and actress Anna Deavere Smith has pioneered a form of narrative drama by looking at the radically different points of view in incidents like Ferguson. She made an award-winning play, Twilight Los Angeles, out of her exploration of the aftermath of the Rodney King riots. By interviewing people in depth on all sides, she brings into focus the depth of the divisions in our communities. She speaks here of how, as dramatic real-life characters, blacks and whites continually play out this divided nation tragedy.
Well, the cops are on the front line. And one of the things, I'll never forget George Wolfe, a great, you know, theater director and dramatist here in the city who directed my play about the Los Angeles riots. I went there and interviewed well over 300 people. And I remember a session working with George when he said, you know, the cops are really doing our business. They're protecting our property. So the cops are on the front line. And when these explosions happen, they become the main characters. But we all are involved in this. Right? That is not to excuse what happened, but they are the ones on the front line. They are acting out the drama. The cop and the kid is acting out the drama for all of us as we sit back and watch. You know,
cop gets permission from the collective society at large
to protect property.
So it's not bad cops, it's bad society.
Well, I think it's cops. It could be bad cops. I mean, how are the cops trained, right? I mean, you know, I just read an interesting thing while looking at some of the press on this that blew my mind. Of course, Daryl Gates, the then chief of police of Los Angeles, was really accused of destroying that city by not going in there and stopping the unrest. He just let it happen. And I read something in the press about this, that in a way, the kind of more strategic thing to do would not to have the cops there because they just accelerate what's going on, right? So if they weren't there, I mean, what happened in L.A. was, quote unquote, they burned down their own neighborhoods. Now, that's a very sort of terrible notion, but it did give me pause about, wow, maybe Daryl Gates had a more of a strategy than people gave him credit for.
I can't resist asking you, you know, as a dramatist and as a writer and as an artist, what do you make of the character of Ron Johnson, the state trooper?
He's very interesting, isn't he? Well, it's interesting casting, at the very least. He is more heartfelt than anybody else. Most of the by that I mean the sort of the governor, you know, other officials are reading from a text. They're very careful in their cadences. So I think it's interesting that one person has to be more emotional.
Does the divergence of the point of view surprise you typically in events like this?
Look, none of us are surprised when we read about a Pew Research report that blacks and whites differ about what's going on right now in Ferguson. We're not surprised. So I don't know if I'm really surprised, to tell you the truth. I'm very interested in the differences in opinion. I'm very interested in that sort of Rashomon about what's right and what's wrong in America and about the variety of values here.
Let's look at the pictures in Ferguson, and we see those people protesting, and there's blacks and whites together. And on the local level, there is a sense of people coming together and sensing the urgency of what's going on. But nationally, we live in bubbles.
The problem.
Yeah.
I mean, here we are 60 years after Brown versus Board of Ed, and most people assessed, I mean, what a birthday party that was. Most people assess that we're more segregated than ever. As a matter of fact, you know, not very far from Ferguson, you may recall last spring there was an article in the Times about the sort of dismay of white parents when kids from a poor school in a Normandy High School were going to be given an opportunity to go to a better school, you know. know, and some parents came forward and said, you know, we don't want, you know, drugs and violence in our schools. So I think laws can do so much. And at a certain point, we as a nation have to determine that we have the ability to care about more than the people who live inside of our house. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are other people who would tell you that it starts with poverty. You know, if we really wanted to stop it before it starts, we'd stop poverty. We'd try to bring more equity in our society.
Anna Deavere Smith is an actress, playwright, and professor at New York University. Her documentary-style plays include Fires in the Mirror and Twilight Los Angeles, 1992.
It's not about police being bad people, nor is it about policing itself being a bad idea. It's not about a white person killing a black person. It's about how black men are perceived as more frightening by the police forces of America, and how the police forces of America have demonstrated this fear by killing them in disproportionately high numbers.
If you act accordingly, you behave in front of an officer, you do what the officer tells you, you're not going to have an issue. And it's not absolute power. It's doing the right thing. They're appointed to be in charge of the law, to uphold the law. And it's not up to us as citizens to challenge that. If you want to do it correctly. Go through the judicial system.
That's Miles from St. Louis, and before that, Nick from Oakland, California, calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's a national conversation. You can join it at thetakeaway.org. Keep talking, engaging. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You. Have you done your yoga this morning? Or did you skip the class today? Is the urgent recounting of the harrowing news in the world that we present each day on The Takeaway, is it killing your relaxing yoga buzz? It's kind of our mission. Just take a deep breath. It's going to be all right. But for heaven's sakes, don't take my word for it.
Life is dependent upon breath. If the breath is gone, life is gone.
That's the voice of B.K.S. Iyengar, the man credited with introducing yoga to the Western world, speaking at a public demonstration in Sydney, Australia, back in 1983. Iyengar died on Wednesday in the southern Indian city of Pune at the age of 95. The yoga movement has attracted millions to embrace what Iyengar termed a thoughtfully thoughtless path to health and fitness. The popularity of yoga has also driven a commercial industry, producing everything from yoga apps, special-powered rocks, mats, to herbal-scented wipes. Elizabeth Kadetsky joined the movement a long time ago. She's the author of First There Is a Mountain, a memoir of a year spent studying with B.K.S. Iyengar. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Don.
Why do you think Iyengar believed that this ancient tradition of yoga could be such a modern sort of trend and practice in the West?
Iyengar really believed in yoga as an ecumenical religion, in a sense. He often talked about the religion of yoga. But he never stressed its roots in Hinduism. He was interested in Vedanta and some of the ancient Indian philosophies. But it was something that even from the beginning in the 1950s when he was teaching in Bombay, he really reached out to an international audience. And that's not just Europeans, but in Bombay, there is a large population of Parsis or Zoroastrians of Iranian descent. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it turned out that that was the community whom he was teaching from the very beginning.
The original monotheists, Zoroastrians.
Exactly, yes.
Well, by the time you get to the 1980s, yoga is introduced as almost an adjunct, a kind of spiritual adjunct to the fitness movement. How did that work? And who were the original adherents in the United States, do you think?
The original adherents in the United States were, you could say, sort of hippies in San Francisco and in Philadelphia. His first trip to the United States, it was his second trip to the United States, was Philadelphia. A teacher named Mary Dunn invited him. And he changed his message a little bit, I think, to make it a little bit more palatable to Americans at that time. And again, you know, it was very secular, very practical. He was interested very much in the physical side of it, and I think that's something that gets lost a little bit, that Iyengar never said the physical should be ignored and this is a spiritual practice. He always said that the body is the site of spirituality, and in that sense it was very much a mind-body practice.
What was it like studying with him?
It was thrilling and exciting, and he was such a character as well. I was studying with him, and I was also doing research for my book, First There Was a Mountain, and so I spent a lot of time with him, not just in the yoga studio, but in his library, where he would set up every afternoon after the morning classes. And he would sit in his library in his dhoti with his kind of wild hair, and he would sit at a desk going through newspapers and clipping articles about health. And a couple of students would be sitting in the library just reading, and I was one of them. And he would just kind of start talking. It would sound like he was talking to himself, but he was really talking to us, but he wasn't really making eye contact or anything. And he would say, look at this. Yoga can cure diabetes. This rise of diabetes in India, people don't understand. Yoga can cure everything. And he was really passionate and a proselytizer, a real proselytizer for yoga. But it was exciting, always exciting to be around him.
It's amazing that he really anticipates the health movement that goes way beyond hippies and the New Age movement. And, you know, you've got housewives in the suburbs going to yoga classes all over the United States, and there's not an issue at all with doing anything exotic. Yoga is very much mainstream. Did he believe that that was possible in the United States?
I think he did, but I think it's also important to put him in context of a larger history. And he was very much a genius, I think, and he very much developed his own style of yoga, as you can see in Light on Yoga, published in 1966. But he was definitely following from a tradition that preexisted him that really goes back, I think, to the turn of the century and to mind-body movements, even coming from Germany and Europe, that were popular in India as well. So the idea of mind-body tradition that could really help anyone was something that there was a precedent for very much.
What do you think the legacy is for yoga in this century? Will it become part of fitness, or will it become more of a Hindu-like tradition in the West as more and more of the East gets picked up by the West in this hemisphere?
Well, what I hope and what I think Iyengar would have hoped is that we'll see an even greater integration of the two. And I think that what he was always doing in India through his yoga practice and his yoga teaching going all the way back to the 50s and earlier was bringing together the East and the West. And he was never trying to forward yoga as an Indian tradition. He wanted it to be an international tradition. And I think in the same way, he really wanted to integrate mind and body and see it not only as a spiritual tradition and not only as a physical tradition, but to get a consciousness through the world where people understood that the mind and the body are the same.
Do you think the West perverts yoga by commercializing it and, you know, charging, you know, these kinds of Beverly Hills fees for yoga classes?
I think that's a great question. And I think that Iyengar might have said yes, but I actually disagree. I think that yoga was always a hybrid tradition. And what happened in India when Iyengar was coming up through yoga was, in a sense, a made-up tradition. And he and his teacher, Krishnamacharya, back in Mysore, they picked up some old medieval texts, and certainly they had learned some of the yoga poses from other people as well. But they created something very much, and it was a hybrid that used Western traditions as well. So I think that yoga has always been something that brings together different traditions and integrates itself into a kind of popular setting. So I personally have no problem with the bus ads and the yoga in Times Square, yoga in Central Park. I think more yoga is good for everyone, and I think Iyengar would agree with that.
You strike me as someone who knows all the poses in their Sanskrit names, but, you know, the animal names are what I know. any favorites, any really hard ones that you still aspire to?
Well, let's see. There are some beautiful videos of Iyengar in the 1930s at the Jahamogan Palace in Mysore, where you can see him going up into a handstand where he puts his hand on the ground and then he straightens his back, both hands on the ground, straightens his back, leans his butt to the back, and with very straight legs lifts up his legs into a beautiful handstand. So that is the pose that I've been aspiring to for the last year or two.
Are you close?
Well, I was close and then I got pregnant.
That's okay.
So I haven't tried it since
That's
then.
That's perfectly fine. My kids like Downward Dog.
That's a good one.
And my wife tries to do Flying Crow.
That's a good one.
Yeah. As a paraplegic, there's not a whole lot I can do, but I still love to see everyone sort of splayed out in our living room doing
Well, Iyengar would disagree with that.
Of course he would. Of course.
He would
it's no excuse.
You would be the best yoga student.
Yeah. Well, I can do Talking Radio Man. I do that every morning. Elizabeth Kadetsky, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Elizabeth Kadetsky spent a year studying with BKS Iyengar to write the memoir, First There Is a Mountain. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Remember to breathe. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.